You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of March, 2018, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Daniel Bache. On today's show, Britain sees Saudi Arabia as a key ally, and will be giving the country's young crown prince a gilded royal welcome. But what is the UK willing to ignore to protect its business interests? My guests Joy Ladiko and Robin Lustig will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the European Council has released its rules of play for Brexit negotiations, so game on and then.
Well, we don't know whether or not he was drinking or anything else, but if CNN had a suspicion that he was drunk, it's not the prudent thing to put a drunk guy on TV.
After a former Trump advisor had what many are describing as a meltdown on several U.S. TV channels, we ask, should we interview someone in a difficult or impaired state? And just ahead of International Women's Day, noble drink makers are tackling gender inequality, but is making fun of gender stereotypes the way to do it? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Daniel Bache. So welcome to Midori House. My esteemed guests today are Joy Ladiko, a columnist at London's Evening Standard, and journalist Robin Lustig, also an excellent blogger who's the former presenter and of The World Tonight on BBC Radio 4. Welcome back, both of you, to Midori House this evening. We start today's program in the UK, where Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has landed today. His visit includes meeting with the Prime Minister, Theresa May, a briefing at the UK National Security Council, and even lunch with the Queen. So Britain certainly has huge interests in Saudi Arabia, but the kingdom is keen to work with the UK for its expertise on several fronts as well, with while growing their investments. So what can we expect, first of all, with the Prince's meeting with the Prime Minister, Robin?
There's nothing new about British Prime Ministers sucking up to Saudi royals. They've been doing it for decades. It's never very nice to watch. The Saudi record on human rights, for example, is abysmal. We sell them vast quantities of arms, which until recently they didn't do much with, but of late have been using to terrible effect in Yemen, where they are intervening in a civil war and causing hundreds, if not thousands, of deaths. I think it's not very nice to see Britain kowtowing to the Saudi royals. The Crown Prince is an interesting character. He is making a lot of changes in Saudi Arabia. He is also upping the tensions with Iran in a very dangerous way. I don't think we should be rolling out the red carpet to him. I don't think we should ever be rolling out the red carpet to the Saudis. But we have pound signs in our eyes. We see the prospect of doing business with them. And that seems to be all that matters.
So, Joy, perhaps, what do you think Theresa May's interests are? What's on the top of her agenda when she goes into that meeting?
Well, I think it's investment, investment, investment. I mean, Britain has got to go and cut some deals with some countries abroad. And in many ways, Saudi Arabia is an easy hit. Mm-hmm. And they are keen to, or particularly MBS is keen to change the image of Saudi Arabia, and therefore he wants to be doing business with Britain. He said today, despite Brexit, you know, we still think that it is the best nation. London is the kind of great city, and it's a great nation to be doing business with. It's perhaps not the first person Theresa May would have liked turning up on her doorstep offering to cut various deals, but there we are.
We don't have much choice at the moment, do we? I mean, the awful truth for the UK, if it indeed it does leave the European Union, is it's going to have to do business wherever it can find partners. And there is no doubt there are very close ties going back, as I say, many decades with the Saudi royals. I think the UK is wrong if it thinks that the Saudis are going to be reliable partners. Saudi Arabia is not as stable as it would like people to think. The Crown Prince is instituting a lot of change. He is also purging any fellow royals who he thinks might be a threat to him. There could be a backlash from that. I rather fear that there's a possibility that what we'll see happening in Saudi is what happened in Iran in the 1970s, when the West thought they had a very reliable ally in the Shah of Iran, only to discover that he was overthrown. So as I say, I'm not happy.
Mohammed bin Salman is being seen as a sort of modernizing force in Saudi Arabia with the latest wave of his social and economic reforms. But the country still fails at many other things, particularly, as you mentioned, Robin, human rights. The adverts and all the papers here say he is empowering Saudi Arabian women, but he's also the driving force behind the war in Yemen. Is it more acceptable to do business because they have good intentions? And on what front?
We have to be nice to people because they allow women to drive. What kind of world are we in 2018? Cinemas are going to open in Saudi. I mean, these are things that should have happened 100 years ago. I mean, yes, of course, it's moving in the right direction, but there are a lot of negatives, and I worry that in our eagerness to do business wherever we can, we overlook the negatives, and all we see, as I say, are the pound signs.
The UK's arms trade with Saudi Arabia likely to get a boost here. How is that conversation approached, Joy?
The arms trade?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think it's a pretty difficult subject because it's now become apparent that these, you know, the jets that we send them are not on the ground anymore. They are indeed in the air, mm-hmm. and therefore we are complicit in what they're being used for. It's a deal that's been going on for 20, 30, 40 years, perhaps, in this country, us selling to Saudi Arabia. Again, you know, you're sitting there with kind of British aerospace needing to have foreign partners. Europe, the EU as a market, perhaps drifting away. And you just need to keep entrenching over and over these old relationships. Mm-hmm. And Saudi Arabia has historically been a very difficult one. I'm kind of surprised by the level of advertising and that has happened of this particular visit. And that, in fact, the number of PRs who've been in contact with me to say, would you like to come to this exhibition? Would you like to come to this talk by, in fact, one of the Crown Princesses? Could I put an article into your newspaper explaining all the wonderful things that Mohammed bin Salman is going to do? And there are some quite big PR companies running behind this. There is a kind of very modern idea of how to represent or re-present Saudi Arabia to the British people going on via MBS. Unfortunately, you will meet the resistance of some old-fashioned news journalists who, in fact, want to look at the story from several dimensions.
This is the first big foreign tour as the heir for the prince to the Saudi throne. He's also going to Cairo and to New York. He has a big agenda, as you said, and there's a huge PR campaign behind it. Reports he wants to strike deals of upwards of $100 million U.S. There's meetings with Amazon. There's meetings with Apple's. What message is he trying to spread here?
He is saying to people, I know that we cannot rely on oil forever. That's how Saudi got rich. They found themselves sitting on a very large amount of oil. They know that that's not going to keep them rich forever. Their economy, actually, is in a little bit of trouble. So they've got to diversify. He wants to find new things for the Saudis to do. There are a lot of young Saudis who don't have jobs. He's got to find things for them to do, because if they're not employed, they're going to make trouble for him. He's well aware of all that. On the PR side of things, let me just be up front. The only time I have ever flown first class was at the invitation of the Saudi royal family. Many years ago now, when I was a Middle East correspondent, and they offered me an all-expenses-paid trip to Saudi to see what wonderful things they were doing. This was, a long time ago, let's put it that way. But yes, they understand the use of PR. They're prepared to pay good money for PR. And of course, there are lots of PR agencies who are only too happy to take the money.
Yes, fair enough. Now, an update on Brexit today, if we can change gears a little bit. We mentioned briefly there Britain needing good trading partners, and certainly the best ones have been the closest ones, but difficult negotiations to come. Today, the European Council made public its draft guidelines for these negotiations, and among many of the things is how the future of trade will look with the 27-member bloc. The Council's president, Donald Tusk, was clear Theresa May can't have a pick and mix approach, as he called it. Theresa May has committed to leaving the single market and the customs union. In Tusk's remarks, he struck a conciliatory tone a little bit, saying the EU wants to have the best possible relationship, but he also said there's going to be negative economic consequences. What's he saying here as he sets out those guidelines?
We are observing a negotiating process. Each side is displaying their opening bids. Each side knows that this isn't going to where it's going to end up. I think we need to take a deep breath. There's still a fairly long way to go. Theresa May made a speech just a few days ago in which she was what shall we say, a little bit more realistic than she has been in the past. Donald Tusk, I think, from the EU, wants to reciprocate that. Both sides want a deal. Each side knows that it's going to be very difficult to reach a deal. They are miles apart on everything that matters at the moment. They've got to find a way of coming together. It's not going to happen soon. It'll probably only happen at the very, very last moment. As I say, opening bids.
So those draft guidelines repeat EU warnings that there can be no sort of cherry picking, as we mentioned. The Prime Minister made, as you said, perhaps her most clear statement last week on what Britain wants. But is Tusk saying sort of hold on a minute here, Joy?
Well, Tusk is saying what they've been saying all along, which is if you don't want to be in the customs union, you're into free trade agreement territory. Mm-hmm. So there's no kind of hold on. I mean, this is like sort of saying, let me surprise you with the Sicilian opening and game of chess. I mean, I don't expect the British public or indeed the European public to want to follow the details. But the minute you just open a couple of documents, you realise this is the conclusion this was the point in the argument we were always going to arrive at. The major problem for the UK, well, there's a number of major problems, but the very significant one that's about to hit the table is financial services. Now, it's pretty much one of our biggest exports. And as long as we're not in the customs union, we get very partial access to those markets. And, you know, you just need to look at the wealth of Britain. It is pretty much created in the City of London, however much we resent it. So when Theresa May said at the end of last week, earlier this week, she said, you know, we've got to understand that things are going to be less good for us. We are not going to be... you know, the edge is going to come off London. We are not going to be the best thing we could possibly be when we leave. Is sovereignty more important? What the Europeans expect, I mean, as you say, this is it's a hard negotiating starting point, but it is fairly unlikely they're going to come to an agreement that the UK likes over financial services. It's pretty much not been done with any third nation. It wasn't done with Canada, wasn't done with Japan. There's a very small section of the South Korea agreement, which is on financial services, but that's about it. So we would have to do something very radical to get that in, get that passed.
I think sometimes people in Britain fail to understand sufficiently that from the EU's point of view, any way in which this ends up will be worse than what we've got. They don't like the idea of members of the EU leaving. They certainly don't want to give the idea that it's something you can do without suffering any negative consequences. So there's no way in which they are going to say to Britain, tell us what you want and we'll let you have it. That's not what this is about. This is the EU saying to Britain, you have decided for reasons which we do not understand that you want to leave. Fine, off you go, but don't expect us to make it easy for you.
There's also concerns about security. We mentioned financial services, but there's things that the European Union and Brexit have to work together on. What do those talks look like and how do they take over?
They will talk about things where they have mutual interests. And security clearly is one of those things. Britain has a very good record on security. It has expertise which is valued throughout the EU. I'm in no doubt at all that there will continue to be cooperation. It might be a little bit more difficult than it is, because Britain is still, after all, in the EU while Britain is a member. But there will continue to be negotiation. These are hugely complex talks. They are going to go on for months and months, if not years and years. Where there are mutual interests, there will be agreement. Where the interests diverge, it's going to be very much harder.
And so with the sort of negotiation strategy put out there today and the guidelines, what are the next steps here for, say, Theresa May, Joy?
A couple of arduous meetings. I mean, she seems for the time being to have tied her cabinet, which was a sort of, you know, very rocky ship, down, and they are following behind her. What does she do next? She's got the problem of Northern Ireland, of convincing the Commission that she's genuine about the offers she's made already, and in fact how those are going to manifest themselves. At this point, they need to start, they need to have signed off the withdrawal agreement. They need to have sorted out the transition period, and they do need to start talking about financial services. And this is key because those big banks actually have to do, I mean, already beyond 2020 in terms of their planning, but there's going to be a dip in confidence in business here, regardless of whether we get to a deal that we like or not. As they plan, they will begin to look to the EU, and we will have lost regardless of whether we get a good deal or not.
You alluded to earlier sort of a bit of a period of reality check, and now that Donald Tusk has been stern in what could happen and what this relationship will look like. How does Britain move forward in that approach?
It's a complex technical process which will go on with very skilled civil servants on both sides sitting down for boring hour after hour, day after day, negotiating, trying to find ways in which they can square a circle. It's not going to be quick, it's not going to be easy, it's not going to be pretty to watch. My hunch is that they will make progress over a period of time. As I said a moment ago, I suspect it won't come soon. It'll probably come at the last moment. The EU has a long tradition of doing what it calls stopping the clock. When it sets a deadline of midnight on date X, then midnight approaches, they suddenly say, OK, we'll stop the clock. We'll carry on for another couple of days. That's when the business gets done.
All right. We are going to take a short break now and move on from Brexit. Coming up, San Nunberg's parade through newsrooms across the U.S.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most weeks there's something new to keep us interested, you know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand. There's something about Tokyo, once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter, every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and still with me are Joy Ladico and Robin Lustig. We turn the focus to the U.S. now, where the former Trump campaign advisor Sam Nunberg had what we can call a surreal night on U.S. television the other night after saying he wouldn't cooperate with a grand jury subpoena on the Russia investigation. He figured out his next step would be a media frenzy, I guess. Nunberg made a host of appearances on cable news channels, including three separate CNN programs, where not only did he call the president an idiot, dared Robert Mueller to throw him in jail, and said the president knew about the Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer. But that was not all. At the end of a half-hour interview with CNN's Aaron Burnett, this happened.
So, Sam, I have to ask you one other thing.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's an awkward question to ask, but, you know, I've interviewed you before. You're sitting very close to me.
Yes.
We talked earlier about what people in the White House were saying about you.
Yeah.
Talking about whether you were drinking or on drugs or whatever they had happened today. Talking to you,
yeah.
I have smelled alcohol on your breath.
Well, I have not had a drink.
You haven't had a drink, so that's not...
No.
So I just, because it is the talk out there, again, I know it's awkward, let me just give you the question so you can categorically answer that. Have you had a drink today?
My answer is no, I have not.
Anything else?
No.
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 Perhaps not surprisingly, Fox and Friends, the president's favorite channel, of course, were the ones to first jump in and react to this interview. And here's what the co-host had to say there.
Well, we don't know whether or not he was drinking or anything else, but if CNN had a suspicion that he was drunk, it's not the prudent thing to put a drunk guy on TV.
When Fox and Friends is playing the ethical role, we know perhaps we're in trouble in U.S. cable television. I guess if we go back just to the interview, I guess the first question should be, we've both in this room interviewed so many people, it's what we do, should we put a suspected drunk man on television to self-destruct?
Simple answer, no. I don't know if he was drunk. I saw him quoted somewhere as saying that he was on antidepressant drugs. Maybe he was. We've got no way of telling. He plainly wasn't well. And I don't think it is ethical, actually. And I don't often agree with Fox, but I do agree with him on this. I don't think he should have been put on air. And if it became clear during the course of an interview that he was self-destructing, having a meltdown, then I think you should stop the interview. I don't think it was journalism. It might have been a sort of rather gruesome form of entertainment. But no, it wasn't journalism. And I think the TV networks probably now, in the cold light of day, rather regret that they hung him out to dry in the way that they did.
OK, so Joy...
Well, I think Robin puts the ethical case very well. But it's a little bit tricky when you see people ejected from the White House and you have Scaramucci just down the phone to the New Yorker. You've got Steve Bannon mouthing off. You know, Trump himself on his Twitter feed. You know, he's a teetotaler and he can say pretty much exactly what this chap Sam said on television while totally sober and dictating it to an assistant. I mean, if there is anything in vino veritas, I imagine this man, while sober, would have said things not dissimilar. It's one of the oddities of this particular White House.
If you are sitting across a table from somebody and you have reason to believe that they are unwell, let's put it that way, drunk, sober, under the influence of drugs, whatever it might be, and you're broadcasting live, I think it is wrong to continue to broadcast.
I think I agree with that to a certain extent, but we are talking about political advisor from the White House.
Absolutely.
And when you get that subject who then wishes to talk and wishes to, I mean, say things which in fact implicate Donald Trump and all sorts of things, I have a hunch that it's actually a very finely balanced decision. I mean, they obviously didn't know that, excuse me, when they put him on. But he said enough that, in fact, justified them putting him on the couch.
Yes, to start with. And I agree, it was riveting to watch and very hard, I'm sure, to take the high ground. I'm not sure I would have done if I'd actually sat there. I hope I would have done, but I can't swear to it because it was such wonderful entertainment. But it wasn't fair to him and... We'll find out sooner or later whether there is something wrong or not, but it didn't make me comfortable.
So Sam Nunberg clearly making the rounds the other night, and unlikely anyone was going to turn off the cameras, I guess. But perhaps maybe it was a bit of a stunt. Where does his credibility play into interviewing him, Joy?
Sorry, where does his...
credibility play into this? Do we take what he's saying as fact and let him run riot on the airwaves?
I mean, the trouble is, this, my point, who do we take as factually accurate mm-hmm. at the moment? Everybody is in a kind of ratings war with each other, sort of driven by Donald Trump. Everybody wants the limelight from mm-hmm. that White House. Is he credible? I don't know. I mean, perhaps if he could pick up the subpoena and not rip it up and go and do what Robin Mueller asked him, we would have him sober and carefully judged and saying what he feels he ought to be saying. Having said that, you know, the off-the-hook interviews are indeed often the times when the truth comes out.
True enough. I mean, he did contradict himself. He did so many interviews and he talked so much nonsense and he said things that were mutually contradictory. He has no credibility at the moment. Mm-hmm. Whether he can retrieve it or not remains to be seen. But he certainly did himself no favours. He did nobody who worked with anybody favours. I hope he has a long lie down and seeks some help.
So for hungry cable news producers, then, where, as we said, ratings are everything, at what point do we step back and ask this man, is he okay?
When you have reason to believe that he's not okay. Yeah. I mean, if he's standing on a ledge and says, I'm going to jump, you don't say, fine, we'll keep the cameras turning. Mm-hmm. You try and help him. As I say, it made me feel uncomfortable. Of course, it was incredibly entertaining, and the clips, I'm sure, have been watched zillions of times since it all happened. It had no journalistic value at all, except we're talking about a man who clearly was unwell and under stress, and we'll see what the effect of all that is.
Joy, did you want to jump in at all?
Well, I think clearly you can allow him to do one interview. You know, various people do turn up totally drunk. Mm-hmm. What was the name of the there was a British broadcaster, Bozenkay, who apparently
Reginald Bozenkay. He was a newsreader. He wasn't sober. Yeah.
Absolutely blind drunk. Turned the camera on. Absolutely fine. Did the job. So you could argue that mm-hmm. you know, if the man is drunk off stage and he turns up on stage drunk, he may well pull his act together. I mean, clearly by the time you're onto the fourth interview, and if CNN is in charge of three of them, you might at this point have spotted that this has now become a kind of circus rather than their kind of great exclusive interview they'd planned.
I do remember one occasion when a British politician now no longer alive, turned up for an interview with me fairly late one night, and it was clear that this politician was under the influence of drink. And when I said, would you like a black coffee? The politician said, I think that would be a very good idea. So we poured a cup of black coffee. I'm not even going to say whether it was a he or a she. And things progressed. But we did what we could to help that politician sober up before we put them on air.
Nunberg backtracked slightly, as he said, on defying Robert Mueller's subpoena, for example, and in a later interview with AP sort of was getting things back together, shall we say. But this has been buried amongst this media hype we've been talking about, and was he drunk or not, that question. But is it the duty of the interviewer then to guide someone who's been incriminating themselves perhaps on TV?
I mean, I'm afraid not. I mean, mm-hmm. I take the ethical point entirely, and I do think there is a point you stop an interview. But if somebody is incriminating themselves, you as a journalist are trying to draw a story out of them. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult at that point to say, oh, stop, I must just look after this person. Were it a member of the public, my instincts on caring for that person would kick in a lot sooner than somebody who's been a political advisor in the White House who knows exactly what's going to be happening when he's on a television screen.
Mm-hmm. I think that's perfectly fair. Government officials or recently dismissed government officials are different from members of the public. You rely on people to be able to make their own judgments about what's in their own best interests. But if they're unwell, if they're under the influence of drink or drugs, then I think the calculation changes slightly.
All right, I want to move on to drinks now. We've been talking about drinks in a sense. breaking news, apparently there is beer for women now. Is this one of those things that might have sounded okay on paper, but even with all good intentions in the world we live in, it just hasn't worked out for BrewDog as they expected it. The company announcing a brand new product, a pink-labeled beer for women ahead of International Women's Day. Is this marketing gone wrong, even with the good intentions, Joy?
I love it. The women's question gets asked to the woman first. Why don't you ask Robin what he thinks?
I'll tell you what I think. I think it is the most ridiculous marketing stunt I have heard. Mm-hmm. I mean, they claim that this is all a satirical gesture, that of course it's not meant seriously, that they just want to make a point. Look, what they want is for us to talk about them. They want us to mention their name. I don't think we should mention their name, and I very much hope that anybody who feels in the least in need of a bottle of beer, whether male, female, both or neither, buys anything except a bottle manufactured by this particular brewery. I think it's the most appallingly cynical stunt, and I hope to God it backfires on them badly.
Having said that, I actually quite like the beer from this brewery. They do a wide range, and in fact, even before they brought out this particular pink IPA, I was perfectly capable as a woman of buying some of their other IPAs.
Precisely
and really enjoying
so.
Them.
Precisely.
This one is interesting in that they've taken 20% off the price, or 18% of the price, to match the gender pay gap, and they're also giving a section of the proceeds to women's charities. Now, I would rather see that little label saying we're giving proceeds to charity on the women's charities on the bottles designed for men rather than for women. I think, why should we pay again?
Couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
The head of the global marketing team for this brewery, a woman, Sarah Warman, said the fact that the gender pay gap is still an issue in 2018 shows that a lot of lip service is being paid, but not enough action is being taken to tackle inequality. But why then do they have to come out with a novelty product?
Because they want us to talk about them. Because they want brand visibility. It's a cynical marketing stunt.
Yeah, it's just it's tacking on quite a serious agenda onto beer. I mean, beer is actually one of the great gender divides, because it has always been marketed to men. There's in fact a friend of mine called Jane Payton who runs School of Booze, and she and I run a women's group, and she regularly sort of gives us beer tastings and tries to explain beer in the kind of gradations you would wine. But she knows very well that there is a huge problem with product trying to explain why there's a sort of cultural divide that women will just drink their Pinot Grigio or their Chardonnay, and they just look at beer and go, it's absolutely filthy stuff. And that is entirely cultural, and it's got nothing to do with the taste at all.
I suspect the colour of the label isn't going to change that.
No, the colour of the label doesn't change it. The other detail is Johnny Walker bringing out a feminised version of its whiskey called Jane Walker. And again, this idea that we're going to, the minute we see this label, we're going to say, well, that's actually, it's really easy. Whiskey is hard. Whiskey is a tough drink anyway. I wouldn't touch Jane Walker. I also wouldn't touch Johnny Walker, because it was my father who taught me to drink whiskey. And he said, you know, when you're a young person, he had a little drinks cabinet, when you're a young person, you start off on drinking blended whiskies like Johnny Walker. Mm-hmm. And as you grow up, you get onto the single malts. And the trouble is, he had all these lined up in the drinks cabinet. So I just started on the single malts, the best stuff, and could never go backwards.
ruined for life.
Ruined for life.
And not one of them had a woman's name on the label.
Not one of them had a woman's name.
Right. Point proved.
Of course. Well, we shall leave us there. That brings us to the end of today's show.
You're not going to offer us a glass,
though. Oh, well, we can head across the street if you like, and we can order whatever you want.
Thank you.
That is
I'll go for the one with the pink label.
That is Robin Lustig. We've also been joined by Joy Ladiko. Thank you very much for coming back and joining us here on Midori House. Today's show produced by Carlotta Rabella, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts. Our studio manager is Claire Urban. More music ahead. Then at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Daniel Bache. Goodbye.